I'm Randy, the pastor half of the podcast, and my friend Kyle's a philosopher. This podcast hosts conversations at the intersection of philosophy, theology, and spirituality.
We also invite experts to join us, making public a space that we've often enjoyed off-air, around the proverbial table with a good drink in the back corner of a dark pub.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to A Pastor and a Philosopher Walk Into a Bar. Today we're talking with someone who I think kind of perfectly sits at the intersection of this podcast, of pastor and a philosopher walking into a bar. His name's Peter Rollins. He is a philosopher, but I would think of Peter more as a public intellectual. And this conversation gets deep into the weeds, and it's a really fun time.
Yeah, it was unavoidable, though. You can't talk to Peter Rollins without talking about some deep continental philosophy, because that's just how he speaks. So if you watch his YouTube videos, I mean, he's good at applying it and bringing it down to earth, so to speak. But yeah, his whole jam is about, let's take some kind of complicated theology and philosophical concepts and see how it can radically alter our experience of Christianity. And our lived experience of things like Lent. So it was like really well-timed, this conversation, because we were having it just right before Easter, and it's now coming out a little bit after Easter. So we talk with him about a bunch of stuff, some of his main themes, which are atheism for Lent, which is this thing he has where he leads people through a bunch of atheistic philosophers and sociologists and psychologists as a Lenten experience. Your wife has done it and apparently really got a lot out of it. Some really fascinating
stuff. It's not for everyone.
Yeah, not for everyone, as you'll see. He has this whole thing about radical theology and pyrotheology, which is his own thing. The death of God and that being somehow fundamental to theologizing what it means to have, he calls it a church of the contradiction. There's all sorts of weird stuff going on with Peter Rollins, but it's all fascinating.
Yeah.
And we try to get to the bottom of some of it. We totally fail. And then we punt to a second part. So that there's going to be a part two to this conversation.
Yeah. And as we're recording this, we haven't even recorded the part two. So we don't know what to expect, except it's going to be fun.
Yeah.
Peter does a great job, I think, of asking questions that should be asked about the things that we just take for granted in our faith. There's a million things that we just kind of take on good authority that Rollins has a really good way of saying, well, why do we do that? Or why do we think that? Or why doesn't this impact our lives? When he talks about the resurrection, it's in ways of, I don't know if I believe in the resurrection because I don't live out the resurrection. He wants to make our faith real and take away all the trappings if possible and reduce it down to its most pure form. That's how I would kind of describe Rollins in many ways, but he does it in a very provocative way. And so if you have a hard time with this interview, know that you're not alone. If this is a little bit too much for you, that's okay. Just give yourself permission to say, this is too much. It's not beneficial for me to think about these things. Again, like atheism for Lent is a good exercise for someone who wants to take their faith a little bit deeper, who has some questions and wants to face those questions with a community of people. It's not for someone who is at maybe a fragile point in their faith, or maybe at a new beginning stage of their faith. Peter Rollins is not for that kind of listener.
Yeah, although he'd probably say, yeah, but he's also a really great storyteller,
and
he's very good at constructing parables that bring you to the essence of faith and Christian claims and make you wonder about the whole thing, but in a, I think, a productive, healthy way.
Yeah.
And he's also like got a great North Irish accent.
He's Irish.
Just makes the whole thing sound magical.
Yeah, we can listen to him read the Bible or the phone book, and it'll be great. So I'm excited to talk to Peter. Well, since we are a pastor and a philosopher walking to a bar, we like to taste alcoholic drinks around here because they're delicious, and it just gives us this feel of having a conversation in a bar. And a Patreon supporter and great friend of the show named Tim has graciously sent us a plethora of amazing whiskeys to try. And so we invited Tim on to sample them with us yet again. Tim, welcome.
Thank you so much.
So we don't know what we're drinking here, correct?
Correct. This is, well,
you know.
I'm lucky I know, but.
All right. That smells like a classic bourbon to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm getting...
Definitely.
I don't know. All the standard things, wood and ethanol and a little bit of glue.
I guess some apple pie spices.
When I say classic, okay. I mean, because this has, yeah, the wood, but it has that library, musty quality to it that smells classic to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very oak-forward bourbon, which yeah. I enjoy. Nose lets you know there's a little bit of age probably to it.
Yeah, it's burning my nose hairs a little bit.
That's really good. Oh, it brings the oak, but then on the side and back of my palate is like rose flavor, like some floral stuff going on.
I always like it when the palate is much better than the nose promised, and that's what I'm getting in this case.
This is very good.
Yeah, it fills the whole palate. Like there's something going on in every corner.
Very complex.
But it's also low proof, so it's not giving you that big Kentucky hug. It's not just enough to know that you're drinking something, but it just very drinkable or crushable.
I've never heard of the Kentucky hug.
Yeah, that's that deep burn down the throat and into the chest. That's what we call the Kentucky hug.
Wow, all right. I would have thought more like the Kentucky belch or something.
It's got some of the best legs I've seen on a whiskey in a long time. I mean, the viscosity is great.
I love this. Simple. It doesn't, like you say, it doesn't burn all the way down. So complex and delightful. Like there's definitely really age to this. Yeah.
No notes. I mean, it's not the most complex bourbon I've ever had, but it's great.
Mm. What is it, Tim?
So this, simple is a perfect word for it. This was a shelfer that is $45 that you can no longer find, and that is Weller 12.
Oh man, yes, it's so crazy. So that used to just sit on shelves.
Yeah, this used to sit on shelves. I feel bad because talking to some of the old guys that are really into bourbon, they're like, I remember when every Friday I just go pick up a case of Weller 12 and it was my daily drinker. You can't do that anymore.
No, what's that, a $250 bourbon now, maybe more?
It's still MSRP'd at $60, but everybody puts it way up, and you're lucky if you ever find it. So,
jeez.
That's crazy.
I'm not a huge Weller fan in general, but I love this.
Yeah, this is great. I've only had this once or twice before, I think, and yeah, it's always a treat. Thanks, man.
Thanks, dude. Man, such a rare treat. Mm-hmm. Cheers to Tim and Weller 12. Peter Rollins, thank you so much for joining us on A Pastor and a Philosopher Walk Into a Bar.
Oh, well, it's great to be here. I really appreciate the invitation. And as I was saying to you off air, sometimes you do podcasts and people haven't, you know, don't really know what you're about. But you guys sent me some questions and I'm actually intimidated because you obviously know your stuff and you've looked at my work. So I'm expecting to be grilled.
Don't butter us up and say you're intimidated because we know you're not. So let's just get out who you are. I'm sure tons of our listeners know who you are, and I'm sure there's some who don't. Your website says that you are an author, philosopher, storyteller, producer, and public speaker who has gained international reputation for overturning traditional notions of religion, and here's what I love, forming churches that preach the good news that we can't be satisfied, that life is difficult, and that we don't know the secrets. Now, that's super tasty, and we could talk for a half hour about that alone, but what do you see as your role personally within philosophy, within theology, within Christianity even? What do you do, Pete?
I'll break the fourth wall here and maybe give you the gist of what I'm doing without the working out. And as you will know very well, that's a bad thing to do. Like, philosophy is the art of doing philosophy. It's not about getting the right answer so much as doing the right working out, right? So I'm going to break that rule, that cardinal rule of philosophy, and try to get to the heart of what I'm doing, and then we can work backwards and maybe pick it apart.
Perfect.
But I am working within a field of philosophy, theology, and other disciplines that, not to put too fine a point on it, would say that contradiction, conflict, asymmetry is a dimension of reality, not something that you can overcome, right? So we can feel dissatisfied in our lives and fantasize meeting a person who will fix that, or getting some product, or making enough money, or finding a religion that will kind of get rid of the dissatisfaction. I would argue that dissatisfaction, but not just dissatisfaction, I'm actually arguing at the very level of mathematics and physics, there is a certain asymmetry, a certain void, a certain lack that we are obsessed with trying to overcome, but actually that we need to make space for and kind of embrace. So in that introduction that you read, when it talks about the good news that, you know, life is shit and we don't have the answer, the reason why that is kind of good news is the opposite of most forms of therapy, and it's the opposite of what is often called mental health. Mm-hmm. Mental health is usually defined as helping people to integrate better into their lives, to be more productive citizens, to be more productive workers, to kind of make life work a bit better. And therapy is often designed to help overcome obstacles. And those are fine things in themselves, but at a deeper level, psychoanalysis would, I think, show us that obstacles are part of existence, part of who we are. And actually, we need to learn to enjoy those obstacles, enjoy those impossibilities, rather than attempt to overcome them. Mm-hmm. Is that a good spot to start?
Yes, it is.
It could take us 5 hours to unpack that, but yeah.
Totally could. Where does that bump into Christianity for you?
So this is what's interesting to me is Christianity. Now, I'm not talking about confessional Christianity here, and I have to say that sometimes because I forget to say that, and then people are thinking I'm talking about the type of church that you see at the end of your street, right? But in all religions as such, and if for the sake of simplicity, we talk about religion in terms of, well, let's say in terms of achieving a type of oneness or wholeness or completeness, right? Sure. Whether basically we're in an illusion of dissatisfaction, we have to pierce the veil of illusion, or whether it's ontological, it's real, and we have to some way to overcome that. We could talk about religion as this attempt to kind of like enter into a oneness and a wholeness and a completeness, et cetera, et cetera. And God is often described as the one that lacks the lack. God is whole and complete. And actually, in most religions, you find a three-tier structure, which is an original blessing, an original oneness, a fall from that original blessing, and then a return, a promised return to that, right? In sacred and secular forms, that's your three-part dance. So Christianity doesn't affirm original sin generally, because they really is an original blessing. There was a wholeness and a completeness, then there's a fall, and then there's a return to wholeness. What's interesting to me about Christianity is in Christianity, you don't really believe in God, right? Of course, you know, a lot of Christians believe in God or whatever, but that's not the interesting bit. Maybe you throw a stone and you'll find someone who believes in God. Technically, Christians believe in the death of God. That's really interesting, right? And what does believing in the death of God mean? Again, a lot to unpack, but I'll try and get to the core of what I think is that for me, to believe in the death of God is what I would call a double kenosis, right? It's not, right? Because traditionally people will say God is not dead. If you're an atheist, God is not dead because God never existed. So it's a metaphor. If you're a religious believer, God can't die because God is eternal. You know, death is the opposite of death. So what does it mean to say God died? I think you can mean it literally and not metaphorically, or I believe that it is touching on a deep truth, which is that reality itself has death or nothingness within it. And in Christianity, you have this interesting moment where Christ cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? Which in mythological form is a kind of sense in which God experiences the lack of God. God experiences a division within God's self. And this is the moment when the temple curtain rips, and this is kind of central to salvation. Mm-hmm. And what I would argue is that in Christianity, the death of God is the name for the reality, the idea that everything is divided. And actually, instead of overcoming self-division, we identify with the asymmetry of reality, and that identification is curative. So I think that's in Christianity, a radical reading of Christianity.
Yeah. Would you say for you, Pete, staying within the realm of Christianity, that Good Friday or the death of Christ is more consequential or says more than the Easter Sunday or the resurrection, perhaps?
Yeah, I think they're kind of like intimately intertwined in that, like in the dialect. So I'm a dialectical thinker, and in dialectics, there is an affirmation, there is a negation, and then there is a negation of negation. And these are all interlinked. So for example, someone says God exists, that's an affirmation. Then someone says God does not exist, that's a negation. And then you have the idea, which I will go with, which is God is the name for that which does not exist, right? So as Simone Weil, you know, God is the name of non-existence. So atheism doesn't go far enough, because in traditional atheism, all you have is a negation. All you have is, you know, God doesn't exist. Not that there is an inexistent thing. Not that negativity is a reality in existence itself. And so in a similar way, you could say that this experience of the death of God, this experience of the fundamental lack at the core of everything, is a redemptive experience, is a resurrection experience. This is what can be called entering into not a community, but a communion. Mm-hmm. So a community is a group of people joined together by shared beliefs, shared enemies, shared goals. A communion is a group of people joined together by a shared loss, the death of God. So Eucharist is a meal that you have around the death of God. And for me, the communion is the resurrection.
What do you mean by that?
That this lack that is at the heart of everything in communion, I don't want to say enters into us because it's already there, but we invite that fundamental negativity, that lack, mm-hmm. into the very heart of the collective itself. Mm-hmm. And that becomes a defining feature of that collective, which I think has political and personal value, right? I think it has real value to have a communion of people gathered together around this death, this loss. And so in a way, it's like saying that if the death of Christ represents the loss of all identity. So, you know, Christ represents the one who's cursed of God, the one who's no longer a citizen, who is put out to die. To identify with Christ is to identify with the loss of all identities, to identify with a type of negation. And that for me is a type of living the death of God.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Thank you. It's brilliant. One more just down this line. You said so many things that we're going to touch on in the rest of this conversation, but I heard you say recently that you're talking about disillusionment, and you said, when I disillusion you so much, you'll never be illusioned by anyone else again. That sounds very guru-like. Tell us what you mean by that. When I disillusion you enough, you'll never be illusioned by anyone else.
Yes. Like, I want to be such a bad guru that no one will ever believe any guru ever again, right? So I want to be so bad at that it frees you. Because here's the problem that you'll know very well, I'm sure, is that when people give up a certain ideology, and by ideology, I mean a system of thought that covers over the cracks of being, right? So but in a nutshell, that's what I mean by ideology. Ideology covers over the cracks or renders them contingent. So all ideology says, right, here's the world, and if there are problems in the world, it's because of those people, X, because of the Republicans, because of the Democrats, because of whoever, right? Because of X. And if we got rid of them, everything would be great. So ideology functions always fundamentally on a rejection of contradiction. Okay, this is what happens. Sometimes I get so carried away that I forget the question. You were asking,
what do you mean when you say, when I disillusion you enough, you'll never be illusioned by anyone else again?
Thank you.
Gotcha.
This is also a good way of making sure you're still listening.
Exactly.
So what sometimes happens, but is when one ideology fails, somebody just goes to an ersatz one. So, you know, somebody gives up on Christianity where God is the answer, but then they go into psychedelic enlightenment, sexual liberation. They go into commodity satisfaction. There's a whole, and by the way, I'm not in any way against things like psychedelic enlightenment. I'm not against polyamory and sexual liberation, right? But if you think that those things are going to be the answer, then you're sorely mistaken, sorely mistaken, that there is a certain kind of like, we move from one what to a different what. So at the level of belief, we change our beliefs, but the belief functions in the same way, mm-hmm. and we can tend to get carried away. And this happened in the 1960s in America, where all the acid heads became Jesus freaks, right? Mm-hmm. And then interestingly, at the moment, I know a pile of people who used to be Christian leaders who are all getting into psychedelics, right? It's just the same thing. You know, you get you kind of getting high in Jesus for a bit, and then it doesn't really work so well. And then, you know, that's why our worship music sounds the way it does, because mm-hmm. it's all the hippie music. It's all the hippie fucking 60s music brought into the church. And now a lot of people say are going the other direction because we just want to get high on Jesus, get high on drugs, or get high on technology to take us out of our bodies, right? So what I want to do when I talk about disillusioning you so much is, like, one is there is, I would say, a necessity for people to have what in Lacanian psychoanalysis is called the subject supposed to know, right? It is important for us to imagine, it's not even important for us to imagine, all neurotics do it, right? All neurotics, which is the majority of people, fantasize that someone has a knowledge of them that they don't have. They can tend to, you know, look at a police officer, and whereas a psychotic looks at a police officer and they just see a person, a neurotic looks at a police officer and they see the law, right? So, you know, Lacan famously said the non-duped heir, which sounds in French like the name of the father, but he says the psychotic errs because they're not duped. And what he means by that is a psychotic looks at a teacher and just sees a person. And so they're not duped. They see the truth. This is just a regular person. But because they're not duped, they err, because that teacher can still get you kicked out of school. Right? So psychotic individuals can often have real problems with authority because they're not duped, whereas neurotics are duped. Now, what I want to say is that the duping is an important dimension. People wouldn't go to psychoanalysis if they realize that psychoanalysis is ultimately going to tell them that you can't fix you and that you have to come to terms with your own dissatisfaction and enjoy it. So you go to analysis and you almost fantasize that they're going to save you. And very gradually you do the hard work. You start to embrace your own contradictions and you find freedom. So I allow for people, like in all of these lines of work, to do the subject supposed to know, to project onto me that idea. But then ultimately my purpose is not to do what I think a lot of religious leaders do, which is fall for that temptation and think that they are the subject supposed to know and think that they are some special thing, but rather to use that transference to ultimately help the person see themselves and work through their own issues. And if that's done correctly, then the need for any subject supposed to know will be evaporated effectively.
I love it.
Yeah. I have so many questions.
Yes, yes.
Where to start? Just as a quick aside, and then we'll move on to something else. That whole last 5 minutes started with a question about something you said sounding kind of guru-ish. This is not something I planned to ask about, but since Randy brought that up, it seems to me, and I've actually voiced this to other philosophers, it seems to me that one of the most guru-ish things that there is
to say, don't follow me, I'm not a guru.
Or yeah,
don't...
Yes. Oh, well, in that way, yes, but also like the tamping down, or the somehow my gurudom is beyond all the other gurudoms, or yes. My version, if you want to use the disillusionment, yes. is going to cure you of all other disillusionment. And it's like the best sales pitch, and for some personality types, it wouldn't work for all people, but for some personality types, the best possible sales pitch is the denial of the sales pitch. Yeah. like this is the like brute existential truth about reality, and it's dark and meaningless, and that just draws certain kinds of personality. You could be theoretically a very successful guru with that.
That's very true. And also, but I'll also add this, the reason why I can say this rather than having not to say it so that I can be effective in my work is because saying it doesn't change it. Like, you know, me saying, oh, people will treat me as a subject supposed to know. And we do that so transference can occur. And then through the transference, they develop a curiosity with their unconscious. And through that, they ultimately find a way to embrace their contradiction and enter communion. Mm. And they go, okay, but they still treat me as a subject supposed to know. Brilliant. So it's fine. So I can be honest. And also the structure still works and people still engage with it. But hopefully in an ethical way.
Right. Okay. Well, that raises a whole host of other questions of how we set the ethical boundaries. Maybe we'll get to that later. I don't know how long this conversation is going to go. Okay. So many questions. Let's start because we were talking about Easter mm-hmm. and we're in a period of Lent right now. Let's just stay on that theme for just a second. So several years back, I read a book of parables that you wrote called The Orthodox Heretic. It was part of a book club, and somebody suggested it, and I really enjoyed it. And it was long enough now that I'm wondering what your take on some of those is at this point. But one in particular that I actually went back and reread in preparation for this, because it's about Easter. And it tells, and as far as I understand it, these are parables that are original to you, riffing on some stuff in the Bible mostly. And so one of these little parables is the tale of a group of disciples who don't hear about the resurrection. So Jesus dies, they're devastated, and then they just leave, and that they maintain their community for like a century or so before news ever reaches them that, hey, the resurrection happened. But they've been like consistent and devoted disciples that whole time. And so the news that Jesus was raised from the dead sends most of them into joy, except their leader, who is devastated by it. And so it's kind of a reflection from you on why he might be reasonably devastated. And the way that you write it, it's kind of a critique of this sort of evangelical Christianity as personal salvation view, or, you know, fire insurance or whatever. And it definitely works as that, but it hit me differently this time when I reread it. And so I'm curious how you think about it this far later. Because when I reread it this time, it feels, you describe it as like a prolonged Holy Saturday for these people, like a century-long Holy Saturday, which I get. But to me, it feels more like the absence of Lent altogether, because there is no resurrection. And so the religion that they've been practicing for like a century, to me, is an ethic, and that's distinct mm-hmm. from a religion, right?
Yes.
And I don't mean that as a put down. I think it's an admirable thing to have a consistent ethic like that, but it is still merely an ethic. And for me personally, that makes it existentially empty. It's not a religion. So I think of this in like Kierkegaardian terms, right? So we've got this character Climacus who represents in some ways the most religious you can be without ever actually having faith. And that's to me what that community is, because unless there is a defeat of death in a risen God, there simply isn't Christianity, at least not in a Kierkegaardian sense. There is no faith. There's no worship. And I'm somebody saying that as I don't know whether I believe in a bodily resurrection. Like that changes based on the month, you know, or what's going on in my life. So all that to say, how do you think about that parable now? What does it mean to you now?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I'm doing a book study on my first book at the moment, and, you know, entering into a very critical engagement with that first book. And I would definitely also enter into a critical engagement with a lot of what's in that book that you're talking about, The Orthodox Heretic. And yes, I think that there is an issue with that parable. I knew what I was attempting to do, and parables obviously can have a contextual dimension. And I think that someone might get something interesting out of it still. I probably was reflecting on the idea of what does it mean to have a non-economic form of religion? That was so I'll take something that I liked out of the parable first, and then I'm going to come around to agreeing with you, maybe for opposite reasons, but is what I was trying to explore. One of the interesting things about predestination, which is wonderful, I mean, one of the things that most people miss, Slavoj Žižek talks about this, and he put me onto it, but Žižek really affirmed predestination because of its ability to free you from an economic form of ethics. Because if you're predestined to be saved or not, well, there's no point trying to be good to win God's favor or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. You're good. You're going to be good or not. Like the economic reward mm-hmm. punishment thing is actually completely taken out of predestination, which is very freeing, because then you just go, well, are you a dick or not, right? Because you know, you're not trying to do it to win God. So that's what I was trying to explore with that parable. And actually the end, which I'll just mention, because you didn't say it explicitly, maybe you didn't want to give away the ending, but the reason why the leader was unhappy was because of this, because they try to live the teachings of Christ, of Jesus, without thought of any eternal reward. They just did it because they believed in these teachings. Yeah. Now he was worried that because of resurrection, that people would just follow Jesus to get to heaven. Right? Yeah. So that's mm-hmm. the punchline mm-hmm. of the parable. Yeah. So, however, in trying to critique an economic thing and also get the reader to think about that, what's the difference between gift and economy, right? Gift is a non-economic sacrifice. That was the purpose of it. But the problem with it is it's all too easily progressive. It sounds like mm-hmm. a red letter Christian parable, and I'm fundamentally, you know, not a progressive. I'm not a red letter Christian. And there's a number of reasons for that. And one is exactly what you said, is it's an empty ethics. Great. Be good. That's not religious. That's being part of being human, right? You know, yeah. There's nothing overly interesting about what you find in Christianity as to any other religion. There might only be one ethical innovation in Christianity. You know, it's forgive somebody before they ask for forgiveness is potentially the only, you know, vaguely interesting thing. What is of primary interest to me in Christianity is what you're touching on, which is, and I'm a very big fan of Kierkegaard. I'm more of a Hegelian, but I like Kierkegaard.
I don't think that's possible, for what it's worth. Kierkegaard was huge critic of Hegel, just so we're clear.
Well, that's true. But there's a question mark as to whether Kierkegaard was really a critic of a certain reading of Hegel. Yeah. Yes, and actually whether you can integrate Hegel or Kierkegaard into Hegel, which I would say you can. But anyway, that's beside the point. Kierkegaard basically got taught by who was it? Not Schopenhauer. But basically, Kierkegaard was very influenced by the lectures of one of the thinkers at the time who was very, very critical of Hegel. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so the thing about the parable is, yes, it's about being good. It's about not having a rewards-based ethics. Fine. But actually, the interesting thing about Christianity for me is the death of God is precisely, yeah. Precisely this idea of negation and precisely this idea of not being a nice person. That's fine. Let's all try to be nice people. But what does it mean to identify with a fundamental negativity at the heart of everything? That's mm-hmm. what I'm interested in. I don't think progressivism does that, because progressivism is basically, I think, more ethical than anything else. Jesus was crucified because he was a nice guy, tried to stand up against injustice, and this is what happens if you stand up against injustice. Great, nothing wrong with that kind of thing, but it doesn't really rise to the level of Christology. Mm-hmm. I'm closer to conservatives and fundamentalists here in the sense of I'm interested in Christology, but I am the opposite of fundamentalists in that I think Christology is ultimately about the death of God, not about God as substance, but about God as absolute negativity.
Mm-hmm. But it's the defeat.
So I'm agreeing with you. Basically, I'm saying you're right. You're right. And I'm embarrassed about some of those parables.
Okay. Well, my intention was not to make you embarrassed about anything, but to see how you've rethought it. Because that's kind of your thing, right? Is to rethink these things and continually revisit similar stories and see the new meanings that they have. So can we camp here just for a second? Or did you have something just really burning that...
I've got things, but you can go.
Okay. And I can kind of combine this with my other question, which is about atheism for Lent, while we're on the theme of Lent. So maybe describe briefly what atheism for Lent is, why it exists. So just some background for me. I remember when I graduated college, my philosophical mentor handed me two books on graduation, and one of them was Merrill Westfall's Suspicion and Critique from the early 90s that makes this case that we should read particularly the kind of, you describe them as functional atheists or economic atheists or psychological atheists like Marx and Freud and Nietzsche. We should read these people for Lent. That was his thesis. And it's
atheism for Lent, by the way, do you know that? That's where I was inspired to do atheism for Lent.
I was going to ask you if it was. Anyway, yeah. Yes. Yeah. And so I loved that. And I had you know, had that very experience with Nietzsche, like deepening my faith in a way that he probably would have hated, but like recognizing that he was super right about most of it. And then that changing fundamentally how I related to God and the church. And so I really like what you do with Atheism for Lent, and I want you to describe it a little bit. But the more I hear you talk about this negation stuff, the less sure I am, if I'm just totally honest. I'm struggling to make sense of it, to be honest. And yeah. That includes the idea that somehow the death of God is primary, when to me the resurrection is primary, which is very directly the overcoming of the death of God and of all death. And that life is the point. And there's also, yeah, I think, a deeper Hegelian thing going on here that I just don't understand. So my background is probably more analytic, but I went to a department that had a lot of continental influence. So I've read lots of different kinds of philosophy, and I've just never been able to have a straight conversation with a Hegelian. maybe you can help me understand what the hell dialectic means. Because you talk about, there's parts of this that I can really get on board with, but when you take it to a certain extent, it's like, it stops making sense to me. So like, you talk about when you critique something so hard that the next version of that thing comes out of the critique, right? Or you, I think you use the phrase sublimation when you're talking about it. So you have a thesis and you have an antithesis, and like when they get to their fullest point, it's not at their weak points, I heard you say, that the true critique comes in. It's when they're like at their strongest point, and then they kind of sprout their own critique, right? But I just think of all these counterexamples, but that's just clearly not true. like sometimes yes, you yes. just have a fundamental disagreement. And I would think of theism and atheism as a great example of this, which is you do a whole lot with there being this other thing that comes out of that seeming disagreement, but then there's actually this some kind of synthesis later. But to me, it's like, if I try to make a synthesis out of that, at bottom I'm doing a disservice to both sides, because there really is a true fundamental, as far as I can tell, impassable disagreement between people who call themselves atheists and people who call themselves theists. And making some interesting philosophical third thing is fine, but it's not what they're doing.
Yeah.
So that's a whole lot of stuff I just threw at you. Do with it what you will.
Wonderful. There's a lot in that. And I'm tempted to go a couple of directions. So you maybe choose your own adventure here. One is I might try to go, because what you're describing, when I talk about a thesis, antithesis, or an affirmation, negation, negation of negation, and you can say, yes, we can think of lots of counterexamples. So maybe, but that's kind of almost like, you know, a very simple example. What might be interesting is to go to an example that I think is much stronger, a stronger definition of what I mean by dialectics that I think would appeal to an analytic philosopher. So I'm trained in continental philosophy, as you know. I did do a little bit of analytic philosophy. And personally, I'm very interested. Do you know the physicist Roger Penrose at all?
Yeah.
He's a very interested mathematician and physicist. He's not a philosopher, but you know, analytic philosophers will like that stuff more than continentals. Anyway, I think I can use some of his work to describe what I mean by dialectics. So should we do Atheism for Lent first? Maybe I'll give a little bit of an overview of what Atheism for Lent is, and we can go from there.
Perfect.
Atheism for Lent is a decentering practice that I do designed to help people enter into and feel this relationship and this discussion and this dance between affirmation and negation. And so, you know, over Lent, people every day get a reflection from a great thinker. I mentioned that the book that inspired this was Merrill Westphal's Suspicion and Faith that you mentioned. And interestingly, that book, he's a confessional Catholic philosopher. It was really just reading Nietzsche, Freud, Marx, and Feuerbach as kind of like purification readings. Atheism for Lent has developed a lot since I was teaching that book. Now what it is the first week we look at standard arguments for the existence of God, you know, the teleological, cosmological, ontological arguments. Then the next week, so that's the affirmation, God exists. The next week then is the first negation. And that's kind of what you can describe as traditional atheism. We look at the best arguments that are kind of like argue that God doesn't exist, from things like logical inconsistency, you know, the problem of evil, to the burden of proof, to, you know, the various arguments that have been used by philosophers to critique atheism. Mm-hmm. Now, week three is where it gets interesting, because week three enters the first form of what I would call theological atheism. So most people today think that atheism and theism are completely opposed. And if you watch YouTube videos, there's a theist and an atheist and they get together. But actually, there's lots of shapes of atheism and theism. So the mystics were a group, and continue to be, there continue to be mystics, who really drew out the idea that the word God is a signifier that signifies something beyond signification. So that's a very key concept, right? And Anselm is really the one who gives that definition of God. So we have all of these words that signify things, but when we use the word God, we are describing a reality that is beyond signification. And one of the results of that is that you have to negate all the things you think, right? Because that's idolatry, right? So there's a form of atheism as a purification process where you have to disbelieve what you say about God. So there's a naming of God and a denaming of God. Anselm basically, as you know, in the Proslogion said that God, I mean, he basically said this, is God is that than, we said this exactly actually, God is that than which none greater can be conceived. And it's a really interesting statement, because he doesn't say God is the greatest conceivable thing, because then you could conceive something greater than God. I could conceive of something beyond conception. So Anselm says, and because God has to have maximal properties of excellence, if you can think of something greater than God, that's a paradox. That's a vicious contradiction. So he says God must be that which stands beyond conception, because God is hyper-present, hyper-anonymous. God saturates us with over-proximity, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. One of the greatest philosophical mystics, I think, is Jean-Luc Marion, who, you know, argues very, very well for this idea of God as, or religious experience as, a saturated phenomenon of short-circuiting, that a type of awe that comes from being overwhelmed. Anyway, right, so that form of theism is also atheistic. In fact, atheism is actively described by some of them, saying that, you know, Meister Eckhart says, may God rid me of God, that there is always an atheistic purification process, right? So that's week three. Very quickly, week four is then a negation of that, because that becomes a new affirmation of sorts. And then you get into what you talked about, the functional critiques, people like Freud and Nietzsche and Marx. They're not interested in arguments against the existence of God, right? They're interested in what's going on in religion. So this is a massive turn to something else. So what these guys are doing is, it's funny, because what Feuerbach does as a very interesting thinker is he almost says the mystics are kind of great. Be a mystic. Have your saturated experience of God in the mountain. Brilliant. But he says the bit that's the excremental remainder, right, is religion. So the mystics are the original spiritual but not religious, right? And by spiritual but not religious, it's like you can have this spiritual encounter and religion is the excremental remainder. That's your fragmented attempt to make sense of the spiritual experience, right? So the mystics are the original spiritual but not religious. And of course, Feuerbach brilliantly says, well, I'm religious but not spiritual. And he says, and I think that's what Christianity is. He says, the most interesting thing is what people do, what religion is and what we do with it. And he famously said, theology is anthropology. He says, religion tells us about ourselves. It tells us about, for him, the essence of humanity, et cetera, et cetera. But Marx, you know, made that more precise. But still the move is interesting. This is the move to going like, the bit that you're throwing away, that's really interesting. That's something that we can do something with. Anyway, so that's then the negation of the mystics of sorts. It's a different type of negation, but it's like, go have your spiritual experience, but leave us with the religion. And then the week after that is the theological existentialists, who fully embrace the imminent critique and go like, it's religion and the meatiness of religion and everything that's going on. That's the interesting stuff. But in that, there is something otherwise than being. So that's a different shape. That's not the mystics who say God is hyper-being. In someone like Paul Tillich, God is the ground of being. That's a different shape of religion. And then it keeps going and we go through another shape of religion. But the point of atheism for Lent is you start to see that atheism and theism have had different forms of relationship. than just the they're opposed. They become increasingly enmeshed in an interesting way. And the reason for doing this up to Lent is because at Lent you experience God, in the words of G.K. Chesterton, kind of experiencing a form of existential atheism. my God, mm-hmm. why have you forsaken me? So anyway, that's what atheism for Lent is. And it's an attempt to help people experience how negation is a part of the life of religion and not the opposite of it.
Yeah.
Good.
Do you want me to give you, like, I think a proof that you might find convincing about what I'm saying?
I don't care if Kyle does.
If
I do.
You think
yes.
you can.
Okay. okay. Well, I'm writing about this at the moment. I've got back to writing. I'm writing a book at the moment. And I'm delving in, which is a bad idea, but into mathematics and physics. I'm very interested in Gödel's incompleteness theorem mm-hmm. because, in a nutshell, Gödel's incompleteness theorem proves that a mathematical system that it tries to be complete and consistent will always have a non-computable dimension. So that means that there is, if you are a naturalist in the terms of C.S. Lewis, and if you're a materialist and you go, everything in the universe is computable, theoretically, with a big enough brain, well, Gödel's incompleteness theorem says, well, no, there's one exception to that. There's everything is computable, except there is also something that is true but not provable. Right? That's Gödel's thing. And if people want to understand it in a very superficial way, as one a very good analogy is, if I invented, and this wasn't my metaphor, somebody else's, but if we imagine that we've built a universal truth machine, a machine that can compute anything and prove anything that we put into it, then Gödel basically showed that you could put this machine into a corner and do something like James T. Kirk did once in one of the episodes of Star Trek, where he said you can make one statement that the universal truth machine can't prove, but that's true. And basically that statement is G, an algebraic term, G equals the universal truth machine cannot, will never say this is true. Right? And so you can't put that into the machine, because if the machine proves it's true, then it's false. So it can't do anything with it, but it's true. It's a true statement that cannot be proved. Now, Roger Penrose argues is, in a similar way, one of the problems with physics that we have is, how do you have a theory of everything, quantum theory of everything, mm-hmm. right? You've got the deterministic world of general relativity, and then you've got the quantum world of non-determinism, right? And wave function.
Well, that's controversial.
Yes, that's controversial. Okay. Well, that's good. Yes, and we'll go with it for a second, and then I'll give you Penrose's response. And then, yes, if you want to, we can unpick it. But at the moment, there isn't a theory of everything, right? At the moment, mm-hmm. one thing that's really struggling is quantum mechanics can't deal with gravity, right? That's the big issue, you know? So
that it can deal with it in so many ways, and there's no evidential way to choose.
Well, there's no evidential way to choose. Yes, it's all speculative, like string theory, multiple universes, yeah. Et cetera, which I don't go with, right? For this reason, actually, is if it's true that Gödel's incompleteness theorem shows that there is something that is true but not provable, right? Penrose calls this proto-consciousness, right? Because consciousness is a second-order reflection on computational reality, right? So we are self-conscious because we are in the world and we're doing our things, all conditioned by all sorts of factors, but we also have this thing where we can reflect on that, right? So proto-consciousness is the idea that the universe has within it a non-computable dimension, which actually can solve the issue of why wave function collapses into a determinate position, because there's always within reality something non-computable, right? The reason why I'm mentioning all of this, it might be get too technical, is because dialectics is really just the idea that there is an inherent non-deterministic kind of kernel within reality that means that it can never be totalized, that reality can never be totalized. That's all dialectics is. Mm-hmm. It's that notion. But yeah. Anyway, if you want us to come back on any of that, and we can dissect.
I would so love to come back some of that, I don't know if I don't know if I can. I'm getting the cut it off signal from our producer. I'll say one tiny thing that you're not allowed to respond to, and that is that I think you might be making the same mistake some of the physicists I see making, which is they want to reify their formalism and then just not think about the deeper metaphysical or epistemic problems with doing that. And so when I'd look at something like the incompleteness theorem, applying that just directly to what the nature of the universe might be like, one, it's not what Gödel intended. But second, like, what's the motivating reason to do that? Like, there is a phenomenological world that is clearly different from how axiomatic systems work. And I just don't see the argument from here's how it works in this niche, you know, area of physics.
Okay, I know I'm not allowed to respond, but that's terrible. Because you're saying all that and then not allowing me to respond. Let me say one thing. I want to say 100 things. Let me say one thing, which is that, weirdly, this is one of the bizarre things of how mathematics and physics seem to be spookily interconnected. So it's not a big jump to say that something at the core of mathematics might give us an insight into the core of physics and vice versa,
sure.
Because weirdly mathematics gives us such spookily accurate,
which is just another way of saying physics is mathematical all the way down. I'm saying taking that and then applying it to something about, you know, existential human life or meaning or religion or I don't know, any way of describing the universe that isn't in a physical formal system. I just don't see that connection. Like, this tells us something true about the world that we should then find some congruency with how we like deeply experience.
So you think you're kind of, I mean, you're an old school idealist, like, you in a sense, like, we're outside of the natural.
No. I don't want to go that far. No. It's just we construct these tools and these proofs or these proofs of non-proofs or whatever for very specific purposes. And then it requires extra argumentation to apply those to broader things, which is often lacking in people who want to make them mean more than they seem to mean on the face.
100%. And like, my training is in philosophy, so interestingly I've come to physics and mathematics only very late, and also only in the sense that I find what is happening in Hegel has a really interesting connection with some things in physics. But like, someone like Slavoj Žižek, I think, has written well on that in his book Less Than Nothing. I think is a very good book on those connections. But yes, let's, we're getting too lost in the weeds.
we need to talk some more. And again, Kyle throws the hard balls and curveballs and everything. I'm going to throw you the softballs because I'm a pastor, which means that I'm not an expert at anything except for being a pompous dick. You know? You were getting at a lot of this in the beginning of our conversation, Pete, and I've heard you talk in ways like this that I want to just ask you and just have you go on about a little bit. I've heard you say that we, humanity, are looking for God to fill the emptiness, the abyss of emptiness, like Pascal kind of famously got to. But you say that perhaps God doesn't fill the abyss. Perhaps God is the abyss itself. Can you tell us what you mean by that?
Yeah, this is very key. So there's various ways, various shapes of understanding God. For example, I mentioned a couple of them earlier. There's God as hyper-being. There's God as supreme being, there's God as ground of being, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. I personally don't think that institutional religion, Christianity, has so far theorized and created a practice of a notion of God that you find in someone like, for example, Simone Weil, but and others, but of that, in a sense, there is an inexistent thing. That means, again, like, so, and this is probably the big difference between analytic philosophy and continental philosophy. Analytic philosophers tend to think nothing is nothing, and continental philosophers tend to think nothing is something. You know, I honestly think that's...
Which one makes more sense to you, listener?
Don't pull that. I know I'll lose everybody on that. But then I've got the chance to convince them here. So you could say that zero is an interesting thing. Like, that zero was a very controversial number, and some people thought it was demonic because nothing doesn't exist. So when you signify nothing by putting a circle and going, that signifies nothing, some people thought that was anti-God, because God is everything, and to symbolize nothing, to symbolize privation, is to kind of symbolize what is not God. But the zero is just a rendering nothing into something. We do it all the time, but that's a form of nothing into something. Square root of minus one, imaginary numbers, et cetera, et cetera. So in a nutshell, I want to argue, like, here's very practically, I'll say it very practically, we live in what, you know, Byung Chul Han calls the world of pure positivity. It sees the day, life hack, you know, to be the best that you can be, et cetera, et cetera. And it be. And even negativity now becomes a way of being more positive. You do therapy in order to be a better worker. You sleep because that actually makes you more efficient. You know, you kind of like, you know, in, I lived in LA, people can't even do drugs without it having to mean something. You know, you can't just get up your head. Like, you know, you have to do it to meet God or to be creative or to kind of, you know, be one with everybody, right? There's so even spaces, religious spaces, because this, you know, festival is a religious thing, which was basically a sheer destruction without reward. Like, you destroy an animal, you don't eat it, right? So you're getting rid of this realm of negativity, the negative. And we're in this, I say, world of pure positivity. And I think some of the symptoms of pure positivity are fatigue, burnout, depression. I would argue as well, more controversially, but even certain things like autism, can be seen as interconnected with these, with the world of pure positivity that we're in. So when I talk about the need for a desert in the oasis, for a space of pure negativity, for this experience of negation and contradiction at the heart of everything, one is I'm thinking it is very important for our own health. I believe it's also very important for politics. But also I want to say, There is a precedent to saying that the signifier God signifies that which cannot be signified, i.e. it signifies negation. So the mystics were the first to explore that. But there's other ways to understand that idea. But I would say that I am being very traditional when I say that God is a signifier that signifies that which cannot be signified. Therefore, God is a signifier that signifies a negation, a lack. And that's vitally important.
So kind of related to some of that, in one of your videos, I think it was a video on this Church of the Contradiction thing that you're doing, which if you want to briefly set up, that's fine. You talk about, and I think it's related to what we were just saying about negativity, you talk about the, this is how I read it anyway, the inadequacy of epistemic humility, which is where maybe a lot of progressive religious folks end up, and that like piqued my attention because we talk about that all the time on our show. It's kind of our recurring theme. I introduced Randy way back at the beginning to this idea of epistemic humility.
And as a pastor, I was like, no, but no pastors have epistemic humility, let's be honest.
Yeah, and so it's kind of honestly what we aim for on the podcast. It's a very Socratic thing for me. Like, if I can get my students to just at the end of a course admit that they didn't know what they thought they knew coming into the course, I've succeeded philosophically. And we aim for something very similar here. But you seemed like you thought there was like an inadequacy in that view, and it's related to your whole thing on negativity. So can you spell that out for us a little bit?
Yeah, and if you allow me, I'll tell a little story and then unpack it very quickly. It's a little story that I told the first time I ever spoke publicly, and it was, it's not my story, but three people die on the same day, mystic, an evangelical pastor, and this fundamentalist. They all go to heaven, and as we know, you have to get an interview with Jesus before you get in. So the mystic is the first, and he goes into the interview room. The little signs turn around. He's in there for an hour. He comes out, and he's like smiling. He's laughing to himself. Oh, he says, I knew I was wrong. I knew I was wrong, and walks into heaven. Then it's the evangelical pastor's turn. He gets up, dusts down his Bible, walks in confidently. He's in there for about 4 hours, and the door opens, and he comes out, and he goes like, oh, how could I have been so wrong? Devastated, walks into heaven. Finally, it's the fundamentalist turn. He gets up, walks into the room, little signs turned around. He's in there for about 6 hours, and then the door flings open and Jesus comes out and says, how could I have been so wrong? Right? Now, I love that little story. And when I first told that story, I affirmed the surface reading of it, which is basically we should all be like the mystic, right? That's kind of like, you know, that's the joke. Yeah, we want to be like the mystic. We don't want to be like the fundamentalist. That's epistemic on, you know, doubt and unknowing, humility. But more recently, and in the book I'm writing at the moment, I retell that story. And now I say, no, we need to be more like the fundamentalist, right? That what happened is the fundamentalist goes into the room and is asking all of these questions and searching. And then ultimate reality goes, how could I have been so wrong? In other words, what you find is that doubt isn't in you, just in you. Doubt is also woven into the very fabric of reality as well. Now, that is an argument for saying that there is And, you know, we're going to have to unpack this in our next session, but a spontaneity and novelty, a non-deterministic dimension at the heart of being itself. And that's ontological unknowing. So epistemological unknowing is, I don't know. That's very Kierkegaardian. He even said it, you know, like, we don't know. God knows, right? God's got the blueprints, but we don't. Ontological unknowing is saying God doesn't have the blueprints either, right? That there's a radical unknowing that is in the heart of reality. And here's the important thing. This is the thing, because I'm not a postmodernist, right? I did my PhD in postmodernism, funnily enough, post-structuralism. But epistemological unknowing can very easily bleed into this idea that we don't know, that there's some, of course we don't know stuff. I watch YouTube religiously. I learn things all the time that I don't know. Of course there's stuff we don't know, right? That's obvious, mm-hmm. right? What is more crazy is, what if we can know that there is an unknowability, an incompleteness, or inconsistency within reality itself? And that is not an unknowing. That's actually a knowing of unknowing. We can get into probabilities, but there's a certain dimension of reality that is unknowable. Even within evangelicalism, there was the open theism stuff. So even within, you know, there is this is not even unprecedented within a conservative world. Like, a lot of confessional Christians are white-heady, and they have a version of this as well. I'm saying something different from them, but it's not a million miles away. So if I remember the question correctly, because I always forget, I want to move people. Epistemological unknowing is a great first step. It's a great place to go. But what I want to say is, actually, what's amazing is there is a dimension of unknowing that we can know. And I'll give you the name of it in various domains. But I think in mathematics, it's Gödel's incompleteness theorem. In physics, it might be Heisenberg's uncertainty. In politics, it's called democracy, the non-at-oneness of the social body that creates civilization. In biology, it's called evolution, the non-at-oneness of organisms that create complexity. In the realm of the psyche, it's called the unconscious, not the Jungian unconscious, the Freudian unconscious, right? The consciousness is not at one with itself. In the realm of I've done most of them, but in the realm of religion, it's the death of God. Right. So for me, the death of God is like, so in all of these fields, what we're discovering in different ways, in different forms, is the truth that is not computable manifests itself in different ways, in different, even in sociology, what is society? Oh, is society full of just individuals, or is it some collective that individuals are subsumed into? Well, no, society is the impossibility of answering that. Right. So anyway, all of these disciplines and anthropology with Levi-Strauss come to what I want to argue, which is that this fundamental rupture or non-at-oneness. So reality isn't one, and reality isn't two, and reality isn't multiple. Reality is non-one. It's Trinitarian. And again, this is what I think you find in Christianity.
I did not expect the conclusion of that, so that was a nice twist at the end. I really appreciate it. There's lots more to follow up on. Unfortunately, we've come to the end of our time here. Can we continue this conversation later?
Oh, absolutely. I would love to.
Yeah, absolutely. We can't wait for part two with Pete Rollins. Pete, thank you so much for giving us your time and sharing some thoughts. This has been so fun.
Oh, I loved it. I loved it. I can't wait for part two.
Thanks for listening to A Pastor and a Philosopher Walking Through a Barn. We hope you're enjoying these conversations. Help us continue to create compelling content and reach a wider audience by supporting us at patreon.com/apastorandaphilosopher, where you can get bonus content, extra perks, and a general feeling of being a good person.
Also, please rate and review the show in Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. These help new people discover the show, and we may even read your review in a future episode.
If anything we said pissed you off, or if you just have a question you'd like us to answer, send us an email at pastorandphilosopher@gmail.com.
Find us on social media at @PPWBpodcast, and find transcripts and links to all of our episodes at pastorandphilosopher.buzzsprout.com.
See you next time.
Cheers.